Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Houston, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, September 12th, 2013. And once again, we have our good friend Charles Faddis joining us again. Charles, of course, is a former case officer with the CIA, and he's been on a couple times in the past month. And Charles, if we keep having you on, we're going to have to give you some equal space on the billboard here. I mean, this is getting ridiculous.
Well, I actually had some hesitation if I was going to come on again, because after that last conversation, the guys who run the bubble bomb program came to talk to me.
What's the deal? Are you now calling us from Guantanamo? Is that the idea?
I am, but the cool thing is that we put in a new soccer field down here, so that's great.
So who won the last match? No, never mind.
I don't know, some guy with a beard.
Oh, you mean everybody on the other side. Okay.
So. Exactly.
But anyway, it's great to have you back here. And we're not, again, because Charles has so much really interesting information to share with us, we're not going to do our usual headlines, but there has been some more NSA news, not surprisingly, since the last time we had him on. So I figured we could start off with that, and then we'll just kind of meander on from there. I know Bill's got some stuff of his own, too, so he'll bring that in, too. But, Charles, let's just start off with a couple things that hit the news that were rather big. First, last week, or, you know, about a week to 10 days ago, the information coming out that virtually all secure communications on the net are not so secure, which hasn't really caught the public's attention in a major way. I know it caught Bill's and my attention, not terribly surprising us, but basically what that means is, anybody who buys anything with a credit card, hey, it's not a secure transaction anymore, is it?
Well, I mean, without getting lost in the details of cryptography that we really can't talk about, I mean, if a player with sufficient sophistication and sufficient money takes sufficient interest, there's no such thing as encryption that's unbreakable. So that's absolutely true. And I mean, if a major player focuses on you and wants to devote the time, they're going to read your communications.
And they certainly went out of their way to make sure they could do that, including, and this part I found to be rather fascinating, when the standardization was set for encryption, the NSA actually deliberately sent people in for the purpose of weakening the standard. I thought that was quite fascinating. Particularly in light of the fact that just a few years earlier, the courts had said, no, you can't have access. And so they said, well, we'll take it anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of cheating, isn't it? Like, you get to rig the rules ahead of time. You don't even get to break the encryption that's the best they can put in place.
Yeah, it really is cheating. So it leads into the question that has been kind of the theme of this ongoing conversation we've had with you. The overall question being, you know, is the NSA out of control? Is the CIA out of control? Is the intelligence community out of control? And we've kind of come to the conclusion that they are. I guess the next question is, what can be done about it? I mean, obviously, as we've learned over and over again, there are limits to what you can tell us, but can anything be done about this?
Well, I think there's a lot that could be done, but, I mean, a couple of caveats up front. I mean, what I think is very concerning overall about this, if just even focusing on the civil liberty side, is that, which I don't mean that that's not important, but there are other considerations as well. From a civil liberty standpoint, regardless of how the mechanisms are currently being used, once the mechanisms are in place, the machines are in place, then, you know, if you're reduced to simply relying upon the goodwill of the government as to how they will use the mechanisms, then you've effectively compromised your civil liberties. So having said that, I don't think at present that those mechanisms are being used for political purposes. In other words, I think what you have really is a lot of good intention here on the part of people that are using these things. In other words, they genuinely believe that they are saving lives and protecting the national defense. That doesn't change the fact that we're still talking about things that potentially are major threats to our civil liberties and really fundamentally redefine the relationship between individuals and the government. I think we have gone way too far in the direction of much too large of an intelligence apparatus and one that is too intrusive. Regardless of how it's being used today, it's dangerous as hell. It needs to be rolled back. In answer to your direct question, I mean, our elected representatives and our president have the authority any day they so choose to roll this back, to require changes, to reduce funding, to change the statutory authorizations. They could do that tomorrow if they choose. And I think the answer is that people need to demand that they do that. The argument that has been trotted out ever since 9/11 is that all of this is necessary or else we are all going to die tomorrow. Not only do I think that doesn't answer the civil liberties question, but frankly, I don't think that's true either. I think we are not only sacrificing civil liberties, but paying for and supporting an apparatus that, quite frankly, we don't need to be safe. We could dispense with large portions of this apparatus and still be just fine.
But correct me if I'm wrong.
I agree with your perspective. Let me state an opinion, and you can tell me what you think of it.
Sure.
As far as I understand from everything I read, and I've read a lot, what the NSA is doing in every aspect is totally legal. There are statutes, there are laws that are passed by Congress, there are Supreme Court decisions, all of which seem to, at least superficially, endorse everything the NSA is doing, even though, in my opinion, everything is totally contrary to the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Was that the opinion?
Yeah.
I didn't want to cut you off. I agree 100%. I agree 100%. Look, I'm not sure that I would write a check that says every action taken by everybody in the NSA or the CIA has at all times been completely in accordance with the law. I do think, from everything I know, that we are not dealing with a situation in which we have rogue agencies running around contrary to the law trying to utilize this power against Americans. I think, by and large, they're in compliance with the law, and they are well-intentioned, and they're doing what they think they should do for the national defense. That doesn't change the fact, exactly as you just stated, that there are major constitutional civil liberties Fourth Amendment issues here. And when we get to the point where our answer is, well, you know, as you hear all the time now, as long as you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have to worry about it. I mean, I want to set my hair on fire. I'm like, this entire country was based on the principle that we don't trust the government, that we retain certain liberties and restraints on government. And that argument, you know, sets that completely on its head. So I also think that, as I said before, it's not only, I mean, that's enough already, but it's not true that if we don't vacuum up every communication on the face of the earth, that we can't defend ourselves. That's not true. I don't think the government at various points has tried to make that claim and found it completely impossible to produce the evidence for why that's true and how this really is vital to our national security.
Let me make a comment again and get your reaction. I totally agree with your proposition that there are good people in the NSA with good intentions, trying to do a job, trying to avoid any obvious violations of protocol and so on and so forth. But at the same time, there are all kinds of things going on that speak to not just inefficiency, but genuine errors and misrepresentations of what they're doing. Let me just note a couple of headlines that I picked up over the past week. The Electronic Freedom Foundation had a court order that was executed, and the NSA put out a response admitting that out of 16,000 search terms that they had used, only 2,000 of them were valid. Secondly, another story indicating that Germany has been granted immunity from all NSA snooping. In other words, it's a discriminatory thing. Another discriminatory thing toward another country is that Israel reportedly gets all of the raw NSA metadata without any screening, any supervision, any criteria. And in fact, they came down to the bottom line, which was that they were getting communications within the U.S. government and asked if they happened to notice these, just delete them. And I'm wondering whether those aren't necessarily abuses, but it seems to me that they are far out of the scheme of what was intended, at least by Congress, in setting up the system.
Well, I'm not going to be in a position where I can comment at all on specific things like what countries do we spy on, what countries don't we spy on, those kind of things. In general, arrangements between specific countries to share intelligence or agreements between allies, particular allies, that we won't spy on you and you don't spy on us, those kind of things do exist. That is real. Sometimes then people go ahead and spy on each other anyway, but at least they say they don't. I can't verify the exact numbers that you just threw out, but I don't find in general that kind of issue I don't find any problem with that. I think that's absolutely exactly what you're going to see. I mean, by problem, in other words, I don't have any quibble with what you just said. That, you know, there's a giant bureaucracy filled with all kinds of people at all kinds of levels, you know, going about the routine daily activity. You're going to have all kinds of errors and mistakes and, you know, 9 months later find out that you were collecting data on all sorts of people you weren't supposed to be collecting on. I mean, anybody's got this impression that this is somehow, you know, you're ever going to have a bureaucracy of that size and it's going to be error-free and it's all just going to run without incident. Has no knowledge of how the federal government works. So I'm sure there have been all kinds of mistakes like that, and God knows what data ends up where or who sees stuff that they shouldn't see.
Well, let me ask one final question, and then I'll turn it over to Walt. On the issue of efficacy, the NSA has released a bunch of documents, 90% redacted, with a few cases where they thought the metadata program had actually facilitated the capture of terrorists or whatever. What is your general sense, and I'm not asking for particulars, your general sense of the efficacy of the program? In other words, is it doing any good?
So I'm not going to try to make an assertion that says that there has never been any utility of any kind to any of the data that we have sucked up. I think in general, though, it is not particularly effective. I don't think it comes anywhere close to justifying the expense. If you're talking about trying to balance interests of the public, civil liberties versus defense, I don't think there's any evidence that it is so vital or so crucial, has produced so much beneficial information, that we should feel like, wow, we really got it. Suffer the consequences of losing some of our privacy because this is so crucial. I don't think that's true at all. And this is not a, you know, again, without getting into the details we can't talk about, this is not a question about whether or not we will have technologically the capacity to intercept communications. This is a question about the way this is being used, the vastness of it, how indiscriminate it is, the way it is slopping over onto communications of American citizens, that kind of thing. There's nobody really making an argument here that if we develop information that says Joe is involved in terrorist activity and it's credible information, there's nobody suggesting that we should not have the capacity to monitor his communications and use that as part of our intelligence gathering techniques. So what we're talking about is this vast dragnet without any indication, as if and then somehow magically we're going to run a bunch of algorithms and the machine is going to tell us who's involved in terrorist activity. I don't think it works, and I don't think there's anybody in the federal government who's come forward with a convincing case that it works.
The concern I have with all of this goes back to the question I asked earlier
earlier on in today's conversation about what it takes to make all this change or in some way, and you asserted that what really needs to happen is that the public has to put pressure on political leaders to basically cut the funding and take the power away and so forth. But there's a couple of concerns that I have associated with that solution. I like the idea. I commend the idea. But I also have some doubts. One of those doubts is we already know that the NSA lies about what they've been doing. They lie about whether or not the law is being followed. They lie about virtually every aspect of it. So if they come to us after we have ordered them to shut things down and say, we've shut everything down, should we believe them? And my first inclination is to say, no. And how would we ever check that? Because even the process of shutting this stuff down is going to be classified. So, you know, can we trust any of it? I have to honestly say, I don't trust any of it to happen. Now, the other part of this, and this is actually the bigger issue, I think, is the fact that right now the bigger story is being told by the other side being the pro-NSA, pro-intelligence, Dragnet, you know, the side that's in favor of all that. There is some story that's being told by the media about the Snowden documents, which is providing some sort of a slight buffer against that. But really, all politics and indeed all life, all sales, all religion, all entertainment, I mean, everything is story-driven. And whoever tells the best stories wins in life. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about business, personal life, family, doesn't make any difference. Whoever tells the best stories wins. Right now, and by the way, this is something that is a real problem with the libertarian movement, but it's kind of a side issue because the libertarian movement is terrible at telling stories. But right now, the best stories are being told by the pro-NSA side. I don't really see any great stories being told other than the coverage of the Snowden thing by the anti-NSA or the anti-growth of intelligence side or the anti-Dragnet side, whatever you want to call it. And I guess part of my question is, where is the storytelling going to come from? I mean, we try to tell the story here. We're a very small voice in a very large nation. Now, we certainly don't reach a more than, you know, a rounding error in terms of the fraction of the population that we reach. But overall, who's going to be telling the story? I just don't see where it's going to come from. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I mean, I think that we have a political process, and our representatives and our president have all of the capacity they need to deal with this situation. I'm not going to try to make a case that they are dealing with the situation or that they've been particularly effective, or for that matter, that there's any indication right now that most of them show any stomach for doing it. But they have that capacity. You know, you're talking about the NSA. Well, the president of the United States controls who runs the NSA, and he can either send somebody to the NSA who will sit in the executive suite, do his time, effectively make no changes, exercise no leadership, exercise no real control over the bureaucracy, and then move on to his next federal posting. Or should he choose, he can send just as easily somebody to the NSA who will fire the first person that is shown to have briefed him on something falsely, to have misled the public, to have lied to Congress. He can dismantle the internal structure. He can reassign people. All he has to do is put his hands on the wheel and take control of the bureaucracy. Now, I think, you know, part of our problem overall in the intelligence community is not just at NSA, but at a lot of other places. The president appoints people who have no understanding of the agencies they're running and make no attempt whatsoever to actually ever take control of those organizations. I was at Central Intelligence Agency. I've lost track of how many directors we had during the time that I was there, quite a number in the course of my career. Most of the time they came and went, and I could barely remember their names, and they made no impact whatsoever of any kind on my life or the culture or how we operated. It didn't make any difference. You might see him give a couple of speeches, and otherwise life trundled on and the director went off and did whatever he did at a political level and made not one iota of difference ever. But it doesn't have to be that way, because the President of the United States can just as easily send somebody to run those organizations with a mandate that says, I'm sick of this crap. I'm sick of, there is no excuse for people showing up before congressional committees and telling bald-faced lies and then spending the next 3 months trying to talk themselves out of the corner. You know, enough. Fix it or you're gone too, and I'll put somebody else in.
Yeah, the reality is that the politicians do have control. I mean, the Congress can defund any NSA program they want to. They can release information on any NSA expenditures that they want to, but they don't want to. And I think part of that is psychologically among the general populace is, I don't have anything to hide. I don't care what they do as long as they protect me. Now, I'm one of those who agrees with that sentiment, the first part of the sentiment. I don't have anything to hide. But I am extremely upset that the government is so disrespectful of the Constitution, in particular the Fourth Amendment, that they are willing to just cast aside, and this doesn't include just the president or the NSA, it's the Supreme Court and Congress itself, they're willing to cast aside the whole premise of the Fourth Amendment, which is to secure every individual's right to their own life, liberty, property, papers, and effects. And these are paper and effects that are being taken without any judicial warrant, without any review of whether or not it's there's any crime being committed. It's just a total abrogation of the Fourth Amendment. And they know that. And I think they're well aware that that's what they're doing. But most of the political, you know, voters say, well, you know, I don't have anything to hide. They can look at whatever they want.
You know, I agree 100% with you. I mean, the only comment I would make is you hear people all the time these days say, I don't have anything to hide. I mean, I understand what the sentiment is. I mean, I understand what they're trying to say. But, you know, the first thing to remember is it's usually couched as, I'm not doing anything wrong. Well, you're not the one who decides what constitutes wrong.
Yes.
I mean, you're not doing anything that you feel is wrong, but that's not the critical definition, because you're talking about protecting yourself against the government. Therefore, the government controls that definition. So you regard complaining about your congressman or complaining about your taxes or whatever as not being wrong. It does not guarantee that the government will not decide that those things are wrong. And then you don't get to say, oh, wait a minute, now that I realize you've changed the definition, now I don't want you to have this authority. I mean, once you've given up those rights and allowed the government to have that control, then it's gone forever. I find it terrifying that people are not focused on the significance of the Fourth Amendment. I agree that what happens here is that people use this issue of national defense and threats basically as a weapon and a cudgel, and people are afraid to stand up to them.
So there have been a lot of articles written about how many laws there are, and the simple fact that every person in the United States breaks at least one federal law or state law or local regulation at least once a day, without even knowing it, without thinking it's the least bit wrong.
Right.
But there is something like 50,000 federal laws, totally irrespective of state laws. There are something like 500,000 bureaucratic regulations and requirements that are being implemented without the public's knowledge. Nobody could possibly know what all those laws say. So those people who say, I don't have anything to hide, don't realize that they do.
Well, I mean, we don't want to bore everybody to death with discussions of political theory, but the fact is that you know, if you follow the logic of this, I don't have anything to hide, and therefore, if you really go down this road, effectively you're completely abandoning the entire underpinning for the establishment of the republic and the American state, which starts with this premise of natural law. We have all the authority and the power. We the people. We grant certain. We deign to allow the government to have certain powers that otherwise are ours, and the government only has what powers we decide to let it have. And now somehow we have people talking as if it works exactly the opposite way, as if the government decides and then we sort of and allows us to do certain things. I find that really terrifying.
Yeah, I can only I can't quote it directly, but it reminds me of the statement in the Declaration of Independence that people are prone to suffer abuses while abuses are sufferable. And I think that's an important element in the social and the psychological view and perspective of voters. I can get along, you know, with this total abuse, but at some point it becomes insufferable.
And of course, this whole thing about this whole notion about you have nothing to fear if you've not done nothing wrong, that's really just part of the excuse that's offered by the pro-Dragnet side. I don't know what else to call them. It's actually an adjunct to the story. The main story is this protects you from terrorism. This protects the country from being attacked. Conveniently forgetting what happened at the Boston Marathon. This protects you from all the things that we're so afraid of out there, and which, by the way, we've helped you to be afraid of. So that's what leads me back to the question about the story. Who's telling the story and who's telling the counter story? I mean, one of the things that we try to do on this program is to tell the counter story. So let's just take a moment here and try to frame the counter story. What does the counter story look like? What does it look like to create a system where people can be led to feel safe without having their civil liberties trampled? What does that look like to you, Charles?
I think that it is entirely possible for us to have a considerably smaller, flatter intelligence apparatus, one that does not engage in this sort of wholesale sucking up of all the data on the internet, that is much more driven by the development of credible information on specific threats and specific individuals, and we will be just as safe and will be just as effective in stopping terrorist attacks, and we will not have to go down these roads that we've gone down. I mean, honestly, I think what carries one of the most horrible things in Washington, D.C., is bureaucratic inertia and just the laws of bureaucracy, that bureaucracies just constantly seek to expand, to increase their budgets, and are always looking for more turf and more money, and always trying to convince somebody that if they just get a few more $100 million and another giant database, they can do so much more. And Washington works that way. They throw money at problems. They build a new building and fill it with 5,000 more guys and stand up a new program and fund it for $500 million and convince themselves that they have achieved something, and almost never actually go back and conduct a review that says, did that actually make any difference? Like, how many attacks did we really stop? Like, did any of that money actually have a positive impact? The spending of the money in the creation of the bureaucracy.
Well, we're at the halfway point on the show. Let's take a break. After the break, okay, we'll pick up on this discussion some more, because I think there's a lot of good meat to right, follow up on here. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt Thiessen with Bill Westmiller, and our special guest, Charles Faddis, retired case officer with the CIA, sharing some fascinating insights into what the NSA and the CIA have been doing, and what the ramifications are of the news articles, particularly related to the Snowden documents, have been all about. And before the break, we were talking about what the alternative storyline would be. Bill dug up an interesting story on the story, and he wanted to read a paragraph about that. Bill, what did you find?
Yeah, Foreign Policy magazine did an extensive profile of the NSA director, General Keith Alexander, called the Cowboy of the NSA. And what they're talking about is giving the backroom commentary of what has been going on. And one of the things they refer to is the BAG, the big ass graph, with thousands of interconnections among all these various people, supposedly implying that they knew everything about everyone and they knew exactly what was going on. When they looked closely at one of the graphs, they discovered that these 187 different connections that related all these people to each other were phone calls to a pizza company for delivery of pizza. Now, that's not what I want to quote. Here's the storyline that the advocates are putting forward, and it's an amazing picture. At the Army's Intelligence and Security Command, Alexander brought many of his future allies down to his Information Dominance Center. It had been designed by a Hollywood set designer to mimic the bridge of the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek. Complete with chrome panels, computer stations, a huge TV monitor on the forward wall, and doors that made a whoosh sound when they slid open and closed. Lawmakers and other important officials took turns sitting in the big leather captain's chair in the center of the room to give commands.
I feel better knowing that James Kirk is in charge, you know?
We are in control. We know all. We can fix any problem.
I thought you were going to tell me that they then went and kicked in the door of the pizza place.
But anyway, that was in reference to your comment about the NSA directors and their mental state and the attitude toward this whole thing. They want to prove they're in control.
Well, and also I think an illustration of the fact that, look, you know, bureaucracies will just find ways to spend money, and they will find ways to, and they will always claim that all of this is crucial and vital. And, you know, God knows how many millions of dollars will go into command centers and flat screen TVs. And at the end of the day, if we didn't have them, I'm not sure there'd be any impact whatsoever, except that probably more people would actually be out on the street collecting intelligence and spending less time staring at the flat screen TVs. I have seen some of these graphs, which, like you've described, and sometimes that kind of analysis is incredibly valuable when it's driven by specific pieces of information. Other times it's so insane that you really have a hard time believing that anybody's taking it seriously. There was a famous one a few years ago, which was purported to sort of show the interaction between all these different factors and groups and what was going on in Afghanistan. And it was so incomprehensible. It kind of looked like a giant tornado on a screen. It was just literally impossible to decipher what was going on.
And why. Yeah.
And I think it was actually McChrystal when he was in charge before his run-in with Rolling Stone, they showed him that graph one day, and he said with a straight face, "The day we understand this graph is the day we will have lost." Like, get it out of my face. And whoever the 150 guys are who had time to write that thing, give them a rifle and send them out to do some real work.
Well, that raises the point I was just going to touch on. You talked about how we could actually do a lot to streamline and flatten and basically eliminate a lot of this nonsense that's been going on that does violate the Fourth Amendment and still get the job done without any loss. I'm wondering if you can actually take a statement further. Is it possible that all this attention on this dragnet approach is actually undermining the ability of the intelligence community to help keep the country safe?
Well, I think overall, not just the dragnet, but to broaden the point, the emphasis on bureaucratizing intelligence and the growth of these giant bureaucracies in Washington, D.C. is unquestionably a negative development. It not only does not advance things, it at a minimum slows things down. I mean, intelligence, particularly counterterrorism work, tends to be the kind of work that you have to move pretty quickly. So if we're trying to find whoever he is, you know, and we're trying to, in one way or the other, capture him, arrest him, whatever we're going to do, he typically has his own plans, and he's sort of moving at his own speed. He's not just sitting stationary somewhere waiting for us to get around to going and do something. So if you don't move rapidly and flexibly and adjust on the fly, you spend a lot of time talking about post-blast analysis and attacks that already happened. And the more layers of bureaucracy you have and the more layers of command you have, not only are you have the civil liberties issues and the sucking up resources issues, but the guys on the ground, particularly overseas, are spending half their time answering messages from bureaucrats back home instead of being out in the street, you know, actually doing real work and getting after things. So it's not, I know that people outside the community maybe find that hard to grasp. It is not a question of, if we don't have all of these giant edifices and we're not spending all this money, we're all going to die. No, you know what? We'll be fine. In fact, we might actually be, as you suggested, a little bit better off if we're actually more focused and not spending all of our time trying to process all of the electronic data on the planet.
Now, that would be a story to tell. Because the one driving emotion is what drives all storytelling, right? I mean, storytelling isn't about facts. It's about, you know, feelings and what happened to people and, you know, what they care about, who they care about, all that kind of stuff. So emotion drives all storytelling. And the predominant emotion that stands behind and is the foundation upon which the story of needing to have all this apparatus is built upon is the story of fear, of being attacked, of the need for security, of the need for safety. Well, what if the counter story was we can actually be safer without it? That's a pretty powerful story if you can actually frame that in a well-framed story format, and I think it's quite possible to do.
You know, one of the first books that I wrote was a book called Beyond Repair that I wrote several years ago, and it was focused on the CIA because that's what I know best. And it's essentially an argument for an overhaul of the organization, and it's a lot of specific recommendations, which I won't get into, but in general, it visions a much smaller, leaner, more flexible organization, streamlined even within CIA. And I used a lot of, you know, references in there to World War II, OSS, and other groups. And there are a lot of great stories that illustrate these points. Real quickly, in 1943, the British equivalent of the SOS, the OSS, the SOE, their precursor to like a CIA, sent operatives into Albania, and they were really strapped for resources, as you would expect the Brits would be in 43. They sent a handful of guys, actually two principal guys, and with almost no resources whatsoever in very short order, they began to cause all kinds of problems for the Italians and Germans, and they were very, very, very effective. So all of a sudden back in London, somebody focused on this because this thing that previously had been regarded as a drain on resources and low priority was suddenly paying huge dividends. So, of course, they did the only thing reasonable. They sent in a general and a giant entourage with him in a whole communication suite and went from two guys living out of rucksacks to this big, heavy unit. And what happened was they immediately almost ceased to function. Their mobility went to almost zero. Hmm. They spent almost all their time from that point on running from the Germans in a reactive mode. And then not too long thereafter, the general was actually captured and the entire detachment was effectively destroyed. And then they had to go find a couple of junior officers to send back in to reconstitute the whole thing, which is, you know, in a microcosm, kind of a classic distillation of the principle, which is bigger is not better, particularly in intelligence work. It's just heavier, slower, more cumbersome, and particularly when it starts involving a bunch of people that aren't really intelligence professionals. You know, they aren't case officers who've spent 20 years abroad. They're just contractors that were hired off the street. You know, pretty soon the quality of what you're getting is not real great.
So there's a really strong argument that smaller is better. Smaller is stronger. Smaller is more effective.
I had, you know, the great privilege to go into Iraq in the summer of 2002, and the first thing we did there was focus on a Islamic extremist group that was operating there, outside the control of Saddam Hussein, I should hasten to add, before people tell me that that's proof that Al-Qaeda and Saddam were last operating in an area outside Saddam's control on the Iranian border in Kurdish territory, and they were lashed up with Al-Qaeda, and they were working on chemical weapons. And we went in and for 2 months, working about 20 hours a day, scoped these guys out and got complete chapter and verse on everything they were doing, all of their personnel, all of their locations. Actually put together a plan to get rid of them, but the Bush administration decided they were ready. They were more interested in Saddam Hussein, so they never executed the plan. But anyway, we did all of that with 8 guys and 2 Land Cruisers, in which we carried all our comms and all our weapons and all our money and everything else that we had. And, you know, the only thing you would have done in that situation by giving us 20 guys or 30 guys or 40 guys would have made it, first of all, impossible for us to stay invisible and slower and more cumbersome. And, you know, it would have been a drag. It would have been a negative. It would not have helped us. We had as many guys as we needed. We had exactly the right guys we needed. We got the job done very flexibly, very quickly, very low profile without ever being detected by the target. And, you know, not all intelligence is human intelligence, but I think those principles underlie all of intelligence. That's the flexibility and the speed and the professionalism is key, not the size of your budget.
Okay. So I think we've established one principle. Let's see if we can establish a second one here. One thing that has always really caught my attention where national security concerns are involved is how much stuff is hidden away on the grounds of national security, how much stuff is classified. And I'm not sure what the exact government terms are for that, but that's the public terminology for it. So the question that comes to my mind is all the stuff that's classified stuff that really needs to be classified? Is it possible that perhaps there is overkill going on there and that not only is there stuff that doesn't need to be classified, but the less stuff that there is classified, the more likely that the public and the government are going to be able to make sure that the intelligence community doesn't get out of control?
Well, I think that anybody who's ever worked with classified information for any period of time would say that without question there's gross over-classification of stuff. Most of that doesn't happen for any particular reason other than you're operating in a classified project in a classified setting, so every email you send to every member of the group that you're working with is classified because you're on a classified system. So you could be talking about going to lunch, and you're racking up stacks of classified information. So, but beyond that, I mean, there definitely needs to be, I don't know if it's more oversight, better oversight. I mean, my experience, having been a senior manager at the agency, is that most of the time Congress is not exercising any real oversight. I think primarily because they really would rather be in the mode of, if something goes wrong, being able to stand in front of the camera and looking indignant and claiming they didn't know anything about it, than actually having to take responsibility and admit that they were briefed on it and they okayed it. I know that I have seen Nancy Pelosi stand up on camera and say that she was completely unaware of the existence of things and thought to myself, but I was in that meeting. I sat there. I saw them brief you. I saw you ask questions. How can you say that? That's not, you can't
say
that.
Well, she's a politician.
That
that's how she can say it. Politicians lie. Oh, wait a minute. That's a common theme, isn't it?
I was amazed after the
definite overclassification. Yeah. And there is a real issue with us not being able to monitor the size of the apparatus. I would submit to you that if you begin to cut the size of the beast and reduce funding, that will right there begin to reduce some of that problem because you'll have less to monitor.
The supposed oversight from Congress is coming from the intelligence committees, and I was rather amazed after the Snowden documents coming out at all the different people like Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers and so on coming on news programs and saying, no, I didn't know anything about this. I didn't have any idea they were doing anything like this. Until Snowden revealed the documents. Well, the NSA, you know, was giving them annual reports, 8 pages long, and they were perfectly happy with that. and it's kind of a state of blissful ignorance. I don't know what you're doing, so go ahead and do whatever you think is useful, kind of thing.
Well, you know, back in the day, you know, before the like the church committees in the mid 70s and so forth, it was pretty standard procedure up on the Hill for people to basically say, "Don't tell me, I don't want to know." And that, while the oversight committees exist and so forth, and so we have substantial changes, you know, that sentiment has not gone away completely in some cases. Like, really, if I know, I'm kind of taking ownership of this, which is supposed to be the idea, but they, you know, they try to avoid that.
I agree.
You know, the news that's out today about the NSA, or at least in the last few days, is that the NSA shares raw intelligence data on Americans with Israel without sorting out the, you know, Americans' data based on privacy concerns or anything like that, which in and of itself is certainly a great concern, but it also leads to an instant question in my mind, and probably one you can't answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How many other countries are we sharing Americans' private data with, raw intelligence, unredacted, uncontrolled, unscreened in any way? I mean, isn't it fair to say this is likely something that's spreading across the globe with all of our allies?
So if I did know, I couldn't tell you. We'll start there. And secondly, I genuinely don't know. But based on my knowledge of the law, we should not be routinely sharing that information in any cases other than, you know, when we satisfy certain specific criteria, which means that basically, I mean, in other words, the person for other reasons is legitimately the subject of an investigation or something, that kind of thing. There should be no such sharing of data under the law. I can tell you from my just generally culturally, without getting into details, that when my entire time in the agency, by which I mean the CIA, the real agency, the issue of American citizens was always one of great sensitivity. It was not something that we were blasé about. And even naming American citizens in messages when they incidentally somehow came up in the course of running a case was really problematic whenever possible. If it wasn't really germane, we wouldn't use their names at all because we just didn't want them in the database because they were American citizens. And if they were American citizens and they had to be named because otherwise the narrative is incoherent, then they would not be entered in the same way that foreign names would be entered. In other words, they were entered in a way to deliberately make them so they're not searchable and you can't do them. So that, I mean, culturally, that was the way the CIA always worked, that this is like a big no-no. And in fact, as a junior officer, if you start to write something up, and without knowing any better, you're throwing in the names of American citizens. Like as not, your boss or your immediate supervisor, unless there was a compelling reason otherwise, would just take them out.
Maybe you can't answer the question, but there was a Snowden document that did answer the question, which was released a couple of days ago. Although Israel is one of America's closest allies, it is not one of the inner core of countries involved in surveillance sharing with the United States. Those include Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. The group is collectively known as the Five Eyes. Another report, marked top secret from 2007, states that the relationship with Israel, while central to U.S. strategy, has become overwhelmingly one-sided in favor of Israel. They get everything from us. We get nothing from them. The NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, ranked Israel as the third most aggressive intelligence service against the United States.
So in regard to your commentary regarding this mysterious entity known as the Five Eyes, I will generally respond, no comment.
Understandably.
Because there's nothing that I can say about that. On the Israelis, look, I have grudging respect for the Israelis, having spent a lot of time working with them. You know, they, to use the phrase, they have a lot of chutzpah. They're They're kind of in your face. They're very aggressive. I understand why. They have their backs against the wall. They're a tiny state in a position where if they screw up, they're going to cease to exist. They're not the easiest people to deal with. They're extremely demanding, and they're very aggressive. And they're always going to put their national security first. And if we are looking at them and dealing with them any differently, then, well, then we're foolish. I mean, they are in a position where their survival is at stake every day, and they're going to do whatever they need to do to survive. And I suspect if I was in their position, I would do exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I agree with the perspective.
We've got 3 minutes left here. I'm going to bring in one more question that kind of carries on this theme. Again, I don't think it's one you can answer, but I'm going to bring it up because I think it's very relevant speculation. Since you can't talk about the Five Eyes, or even if the Five Eyes exists, why not carry that out a little bit further and say, if my assumption is correct that data is being shared appropriately or inappropriately, depending on one's point of view, perhaps legally or illegally, depending on one's point of view. I mean, part of the Guardian article that said there was a secret deal with Israel that basically laid out the groundwork whereby this raw intelligence data could be shared with Israel. Okay, well, let's extrapolate and say this is happening with other countries too. Is it possible that, for instance, we're sharing such data with, say, China or Russia or various countries that are generally perceived to be not part of our alliance, and yet who we have regular exchange of information of other kinds? Is it possible that we're sharing data with them?
Well, I suppose anything is possible. And, of course, we're speaking completely hypothetically right now. I don't think so. I mean, is it possible? Yes. Do I think it's happening? No. But here's the issue even with somebody, you know, a country that you deal with that's friendly, the friendliest possible country we can think of, whatever that is. In the CIA, we always say there's no such thing as a friendly liaison service. All services work for their own governments. All services serve their own national interests. When their push comes to shove and their national interests diverge from us, they don't say, but we like the Americans. We wouldn't do that to them. They do to us whatever we would do to them. Once the information goes out of your hands, you have no control over it. And that's before we get to the part that just like people are trying to recruit spies inside our government, in other words, the Russians are trying to recruit spies inside the Germans, the Brits, the Australians, and everybody else. So you're not just worrying about another intelligence service having the data. You're worried about a spy for yet a third country inside that organization stealing anything you give them. And you always think about that when you give anything to any other country, that you really no longer have any control over its ultimate use.
I have to say that was a brilliant evasion of the question. I just hand it to you. They actually do train you very well on that.
Thank you.
And Charles, it's been great having you here once again. We're definitely going to have you back again periodically. We'll just kind of make you the adjunct co-host on the show and have you back at a future point. And Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
I was going to say, call me up whenever you want and hold me responsible for everything the government's doing.
Because you are in control. You are in the seat.
James Kirk, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Talking about a revolution. Ooh, no. Talking about a revolution.